Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. We are taping this on Wednesday, October 28th. The Dodgers are now World Series champions. Feels good, a lot of fun for me, and I hope some of you guys made some money out there. Dodgers favored in every single game this entire season, not postseason, regular season as well. Now, obviously, it's 60 games as opposed to 162, but I found that pretty fascinating all. But coming up on the podcast, we'll talk with Matt and Lou with some UFC, not as stacked of a card as we had last week, but they have a few plays. We'll get into that. But first, Brad Edwards, you know him from ESPN Analytics, ESPN.com, ESPN Radio, ESPN TV. Always has a lot of interesting insight. So we'll jump around, stick with the SEC. We'll do some other games that have caught his attention. So kind of a loose college football talk coming up in a little bit. And then obviously the UFC at the back end. Tomorrow we'll do NFL with John Murray. And before we get into today's episode, I want to remind everyone that if you play fantasy football, I have a podcast you won't want to miss. Make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts, Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on ESPN's Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy, previews, and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
Time now to welcome in a friend of the program, a gentleman who's been on the podcast many times, and a fellow Dodgers fan, Brad Edwards. Brad, we're just going to talk World Series for the next 30 minutes.
That sounds good. I've been waiting 32 years for this.
We finally did it. It feels a little weird.
Yeah.
Maybe because I'm just spoiled with Lakers recently and stuff like that. And, you know, you and I were texting just like the anticlimactic component of the bubble and things like that. But I'm just really honestly above anything. I'm just so happy for Kershaw.
Oh, that's the way I feel, you know. And I knew after the first out in the ninth inning that it wasn't going to feel normal because I didn't find myself getting really excited. And there are a number of reasons that could be, but when I saw Kershaw's reaction, first of all, he felt a lot like I did, which is the immediate response was relief. And then, you know, he got excited and he deserves to be excited because he pitched really well in the postseason. And I think that, you know, that part of his career, it's not going to completely go away, but having this title and also him having been as big of a part of it as he was, I think is a big deal as far as pushing that to the back burner. And like I said, not eliminating that conversation about his postseason career, but at least reducing it because not only did he go 2-0 in the World Series, but the jam that he got out of.
Yeah, fourth inning.
Five, in order to preserve that one-run lead. I think that's where the series really turned, was at that moment. And so he was a big part of them winning it. And so I'm really happy for him because of it.
Yeah, no, it's a good point about the big part. It wasn't exactly Gary Payton on the Miami Heat. In
Yeah, he wasn't just on the roster.
Right, right.
He was an active participant.
Bucci tweeted this out, and I thought it was a fascinating stat. Before they won this year, obviously this was like a week ago, Kershaw is one of 10 pitchers to win at least three Cy Young Awards, only one without a title. One of 10 pitchers to lead the majors in ERA at least four times, only one without a title. One of 10 pitchers since 1961 to win an MVP, the only one who hasn't won a title. So it's just amazing, those stats, but I'm glad to see him do it. Okay.
Yep.
Awesome. Plenty of time in the future to reminisce about the Dodgers. Let's turn the page to college football. Obviously, Big Ten has joined the party. Mountain West has as well. We'll get into the Big Ten a little bit, but I want to do what I like to always do and just kind of rip through some SEC games with you, get the FBI and analytics sort of perspective, and also your eye test because you're so locked in to that conference. And we realize there are a lot of other conferences in play, but we'll start with the SEC. And I want to talk about this LSU-Auburn. My first year doing College Game Day Radio, we were at LSU for this game. That was the one where Leonard Fournette flipped off a defender's,
that's right, yeah,
off his shoulders and kept running. But doing the prep for this show, it was like, wow, the home team just wins and covers every time in this rivalry. Tigers versus Tigers. And the home, like the last like 12 years that, you know, going back was like almost like the home team always wins and covers. So we have a home dog here with Auburn. I was impressed with LSU last week. Maybe they're waking up a little bit. What do you see?
Yeah, I think the question is their defense. I don't think there's any doubt that their offense is still pretty dangerous. Clearly, you know, they missed Joe Burrow. The receivers they lost from last year are a big deal. So they're not as good offensively, but they're still plenty good. Let's just put it this way. They're good enough to be undefeated with the offensive production they've had. It's just the defense has let them down. And while the scoreboard looked better last week from a defensive perspective, they allowed more yards than they really should have to an offense that's not that potent in South Carolina. And so it was a step in the right direction, but it's not anything to lead me to believe that they've solved their defensive issues. Now, Auburn offensively, I don't know what to make of them, because at times they seem like really grab bag. You know, where you can certainly see moments in the game where you look at Tank Bigsby, their running back, and you're like, man, this kid runs hard. They've got a ground game that they can really build around. But then there are other parts of the game where it seems like the plan is just to, you know, run Bo Nix or have Bo Nix throw the ball up for grabs and hope that Seth Williams comes down with it. And they've gotten some mileage out of that, no doubt, but it's just not a way to sustain offensive success. So I really don't know whether I expect Auburn to be able to score a lot of points on LSU or not. It's that one seems to be a tough call for me. And then even defensively, Auburn has been kind of hit and miss this year. It's not as good of a defense as we've seen the last few years, but it's not so bad that I see no way that LSU doesn't run up and down the field on them all game. So much like, you know, your typical Auburn LSU game, I can really see this one going either way as far as the winner. I can see it going either way as far as the, you know, the scoring pace. So it's going to be fun to watch, but I can't give you a strong lean as far as what I expect to happen.
All right, yeah, sometimes you got to pass, but 65 feels like a high number. I know we were on the under last week, and it did not get there with the LSU game, but 65 for an Auburn offense.
Well, so last year with Joe Burrow going against what was one of the better defenses in the country, it was 23-20, which makes you wonder, okay, if they still scored, 23, I don't know. I guess you could look at it both ways. I mean, I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth here, but yeah, I mean, it was a strength on strength matchup last year. And this year, I don't know what the strength is for Auburn.
Yeah. I'm looking at the under there, at least. It's at least starting to look there. We haven't seen Vanderbilt play in a while, which is a good thing because they're not very good. It's been a few weeks. Ole Miss's defense, we know about it, but I still think 16.5 is a short number. This could be a just bully ball by Lane Kiffin. And also, if it's in doubt, he'll want to cover late.
See, I see it the other way, which is that I don't trust Ole Miss's defense, for even against Vanderbilt, for them to be able to lay a number like that. I would be really surprised if Ole Miss lost the game. But I see them allowing enough points that, Vanderbilt should be able to keep it respectable. So it's over 2 touchdowns, right? I think that was the last
16.5.
Yeah. So I don't know. To me, it seems like too much for what is probably the worst defense in the SEC and Ole Miss. But, it comes down to how much does Vanderbilt turn it over? I don't think Ole Miss is going to force a lot of punts. But does Vanderbilt start pressing at some point because they're trying to play catch up and end up making it worse? That one is a tough call, but for me, it's a little bit easier than the LSU Auburn game, where if you told me I have to pick a side on this one, I'm not going to hesitate in taking Vanderbilt plus the points.
But I don't understand. I mean, they got clobbered by LSU. Their offense isn't going to be able to score that much on Ole Miss. I'm surprised you think they're going to keep it within the number. I know Ole Miss D is not that great, but I don't see it. But
Yeah, no, I'm not saying I love Vanderbilt. I'm just saying that this one, if I see it on the page and I've got to check a box on either side, right. I'm checking the Vandy box just because I don't trust the Ole Miss defense to, you know, be able to get enough stops. But I wouldn't be surprised if it went the way you're seeing it.
I'm interested in this next game with Alabama covering a big number, because there's times in the second half where Saban will pull his foot off the gas pedal, which you certainly know, but I wonder schematically if there's a way, because we were raving about Mike Leach and all this after the big win at Death Valley to open the season, but hasn't exactly been lighting up the scoreboard since.
No, I think it's an understatement. But let's start with Alabama's offense and what you figure you're going to get from them. I mean, they have now scored 35 plus in, I think it's 18 straight games. It's the longest streak in the history of major college football.
Wow.
18 straight games scoring 35 plus. And they scored 41 on Georgia without a defensive or special teams touchdown. And really without a super short field. So if you're going to do that against Georgia, you can pretty much chalk up 40-something minimum, you know, for Alabama against every opponent the rest of the way, at least, you know, within conference play. And then the question becomes, how many can Mississippi State score? And clearly they haven't scored very many since that LSU opener. Now we know, I mean, I don't have to tell anybody, this is not one of Nick Saban's better defenses. I think the question is, if Arkansas and Kentucky and Texas A&M can use a pretty basic strategy and keep Mississippi State from moving the ball, why wouldn't Alabama, with more talent on defense than those other teams, just simply do the same thing and also shut down Mississippi State? And I think they very well could. I think if you're Nick Saban, one of the things that you really want to see as far as an area of improvement on defense over the next few weeks is in pass rush. So I think that's going to be kind of a point of emphasis for them in this game. And Mississippi State's offensive line has just been allowing a lot of pressure on the quarterback. So I don't see Alabama getting too fancy. I think they can work on the things they want to work on without, you know, kind of playing into Mississippi State's hands by playing more of the style that LSU played. So I think, and look, at the end of the day, they only allowed 17 points to Tennessee last week. And I think even if they allowed 17, they still got a chance to cover. So as much as it might kind of seem, I don't know, counterintuitive to continue to lay big numbers with Alabama week after week. Here's another one of those where if you're asking me, you know, which box are you going to check given two options, I'm taking Alabama minus the big number because I trust them to score more than 40. And I don't know that at this stage of the season, you can trust Mississippi State to score any more than 7.
I was going to ask you about how much Alabama is going to score, because it looks like their team total will be about 48. So do you think they put up 50?
I think they could. I mean, you could certainly understand if Nick Saban, given what happened to Jaylen Waddle last week, reaches a point where midway through the third quarter, the game is out of reach. And he says, you know what, I'm getting all my starters off the field. I'm not going to risk, especially with LSU being the next game. Now they do have a bye week between this and LSU. But you could certainly grasp that logic if that was his approach, which is let's get all the key players at least out of the game as soon as we can. And, you know, that might cause them to, you know, to put on the brakes, as we've seen a few times when the backups have come in. In fact, I don't think Alabama's backups have scored a touchdown yet this season. I think they have a couple field goals in fourth quarter mop up, but that's the only thing that I could see that maybe would keep Alabama from reaching 50 would be if the second string offense came in and just was not able to score any touchdowns. And that would only be if he took the starters out midway through the third quarter.
Okay, because so maybe a first half team
turnover machine. You know, I mean, I would expect that it's not just the normal potency of Alabama's starting offense, but it's that you would expect that Mississippi State's offense is going to give them some stuff on top of it.
Yeah, so maybe a first half team total could be something that interests people. Okay. So a couple weeks ago on the pod, this is what I love to say about this pod. Sometimes it just flushes out the picks for me. And you know, the Arkansas-Ole Miss game, you convinced me, and that ended up being my best bet for the weekend, was Arkansas took care of business at Ole Miss coming off the hard, you know, disappointing loss to Alabama. So now off a bye, Arkansas is at A&M catching double digits. Arkansas, the 2-2 Razorbacks who seemingly are bowl bound, even though, because there's no prerequisite of six wins. Jimbo got the big win, the feather in his cap, but, you know, short-lived. What do you make of this game catching double digits here?
Yeah, to me, this is one where there are two things you look at. One is the series history, and I'm way, way down in the list of people who make a big deal out of previous year's results. But in this case, I can look back over the last 10 years and I can see a lot of games where Texas A&M was clearly the more talented team, and yet Arkansas always gets up for this game and plays it close. And quite often it comes down to the final minute or so. So I'm not sure how many times Texas A&M has won by double digits. I haven't gone back and looked at, you know, since A&M joined the conference, but it hasn't been many. So we'll start there. And then, of course, this is a Arkansas team that obviously is playing with a lot more confidence. A&M probably is as well, based on, you know, what they've done in their last couple of outings. But I don't see this Texas A&M team as a top 10 team the way that the AP poll would reflect it. I see them being much more in line with the way that FPI rates them. FPI rates A&M as the 20th best team in the country. It's like the 24th best offense and the 31st best defense. And that's what the eye test tells me about A&M. So I don't look at this as a dominant team, you know, that should be picking apart an unranked opponent like Arkansas. This to me feels like, while there's no question A&M is the more talented team, I don't think that on the field performance this season has done a lot to separate these teams. I think it's a close game, right in line with what it's been in the recent series history. So that it just seems like a really big number to me for A&M to be laying.
Yeah. So last couple years, there's been some big spreads, like 20 and change, and they've come down to one possession. And so the last three meetings were one possession. So yeah, a little bit of a recent history there in terms of that.
And think about how bad Arkansas has been in those seasons. I mean, those right. were, you know, I mean, these are years where they're basically going winless in the SEC. I mean, not basically, the previous two seasons, they did go winless.
Well, look, they got A&M's better this year, though. I mean, look, that win over Florida was big for Jimbo. And then they get, you know, they got by Mississippi State. It wasn't the most glorious win, but it was a win.
Go back and look at their offensive numbers, though, against Mississippi State.
I know.
You know, they certainly, I mean, you know, there's some games where A&M looks punchless on offense, and there are other games where you're like, can they stop anybody? So, I mean, they've yet to put one together, and maybe they'll do it in this game, but I don't see any consistency out of that team to lead me to believe that. I mean, look, one of the conversations going on with A&M is like, hey, could they run the table, go 9-1 and have a shot to get a playoff spot as a second SEC team, you know, in there? And sure, it's possible, but I almost would project this A&M team as like 3-3, 4-2 the rest of the way. You know, like just there's just nothing about them that seems special to me.
They're at South Carolina, at Tennessee, at Auburn, home to Ole Miss and LSU in Arkansas.
Like I said, 3-3, 4-2 at best is what I see A&M finishing up.
Georgia, Kentucky. This game, we probably should have talked about this first. This is a game you're kind of high on in terms of just Kentucky coming off a couple impressive wins with their defense leading the way. I've gotten by with a couple games involving them, so I'm very appreciative. But the Bulldogs were disappointing in getting that Alabama game. And the quarterback's just not all there.
Yeah, and we haven't seen them since the Alabama game. And so I would imagine they're going to come out hungry off of that. And Kentucky, you know, they really struggled again offensively last week against Missouri. But this time they didn't have the, you know, defensive performance to be able to bail them out. And so they took another loss. And I just think the Kentucky offense is so punchless right now, especially with the passing game. There's just no threat of a passing game. And Georgia's defense is too good for you to be able to do much against them if you're one-dimensional. And I think this is hard to say in this day and age in college football, Doug, especially in a conference game. But I think a shutout is a very real possibility here.
Wow.
I don't think it's a stretch at all that Kentucky doesn't score in this game. And so, look, and obviously there are a lot of fluky things that can happen that result in a team ending up in the end zone. So I'm not going to say they won't score, but I'd be a little surprised if they hit double digits. So I don't think Georgia necessarily has to light up the scoreboard here. I think that while Kentucky's defense is certainly good enough to give Georgia's offense a lot of trouble, I think that Georgia's defense probably gives them some short fields and, you know, eventually I think Georgia's offense will, if nothing else, will wear Kentucky down. So I think that this is one that should be an easy win for Georgia just because I don't think that Kentucky can generate anything on offense. And I think even if they play well for one half defensively, they'll eventually just wear down and give up some points.
Team total on the Cats is 13.5.
Yeah, that's too high. I'm without a non-offensive touchdown, I just don't see how they could possibly get to 14.
Okay, I like it. Okay, so we've gone through the SEC. Now we also want to talk about a couple other big programs. Oklahoma's at Texas Tech, lane 14.5. And, you know, obviously it's a different year for the Big 12, highly unlikely to go to the college football playoff. We'll see what happens with Okie State. But, you know, I just, this Lincoln Riley, I mean, this Oklahoma team just feels like it's missing some things. And obviously producing number one overall picks at quarterback, saying Rattler's not the same is an obvious statement.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, they're not what they used to be on offense. You know what was crazy last weekend? I don't know if you noticed this, but all 10 Big 12 teams were in action. So there were five games. There was one team that scored 35 points or more. One, and that was Kansas against Kansas. It's Kansas State against Kansas. You know, the team playing the worst team in the league is the only one that got to 35. That is so anti-Big 12, you know, like it's just so what you can see is that even as the rest of college football has kind of become Big 12-ish in a lot of ways with the offense having opened up and the defense is not having any answers, it's not a season where there is a high level of quarterback play in the Big 12. And because of it, the offenses aren't what we're used to them being. That said, I think Oklahoma is going to get better as the season goes on. I think we started to see that last week and how easily they were able to win at TCU. I think at the end of the day, Oklahoma is still going to win the Big 12. I do like Oklahoma State. But if you ask me to pick right now, I'm still picking the Sooners to win the conference, because I think they're going to win out from here. And, I think it maybe helps them that their margin for error is zero at this point, you know, that they can't lose another conference game. I think it helps them in a game like this, because typically Texas Tech is one of those spots where, you know, it's just really tricky and you kind of feel weird going in there and all the pressure's on you. But given what Oklahoma's already been through, I think they're going to be playing with a little bit more of a chip on their shoulder instead of playing like a huge favorite. And I just think it's a bad situation for Texas Tech, even though they're at home. So I like Oklahoma to just wipe them off the field.
Can their defense do that?
I think they can do a good enough job. They did last week, you know. Yeah. What'd they allow to TCU? It wasn't much, but
TCU's offense is just,
well, yeah, but Texas Tech is, you know, they've had their own issues. So I don't think this is not your typical Texas Tech offense.
Yeah,
just like it's not typical for Oklahoma either. But I think Oklahoma is getting better on defense. And you can send me a text late on Saturday night when it's when it's 55-48. But I don't think this is going to be, you know, Baker Mayfield, Pat Mahomes of a few years ago. I think this is going to look like a very, very un-Big 12 like type of game, like we saw last weekend.
So you mentioned Okie State, that you like them. They're 3.5 at home to Texas. Excuse me, that's not the correct. I apologize. Okie State. Yeah, they are 3.5. They were, I was just getting, because I know they were 3.5 last week with Iowa State and the Cyclones back.
Yeah, same thing. Again.
So it was 10-point game. And then before that, blowout, convincing win, all things considered with Tulsa. That was kind of a wonky game. They lost their quarterback in the second quarter. So he's back. They're home to a Texas team that's, I mean, look, what do we expect from Texas? Who knows? But they've kind of disappointed, all things considered. But they got the win at Baylor. I watched pretty much the entire Baylor game. I thought the defense obviously played well. I would lean Okie State here, but I'm not sure I trust the Pokes either.
I do in this game just because I think Texas is being overrated. You know, this is I would think that it's a public thing with Texas where there's just this belief that they have superior talent. And, you know, we talked about Oklahoma not having the margin for error. Well, Texas doesn't either in the conference race with two losses already. And, you know, Oklahoma State, you know, maybe you're expecting the Big 12 to play itself out of the playoff race with Oklahoma State taking a loss here. I think Oklahoma State's the best defense in this conference. And I don't trust Texas on defense at all. This is one, and Mike Gundy has done very well against Texas throughout his career. This is one of those teams that he's won a lot more games against than he probably should have, even though Texas hasn't been that good for most of that time. But this is a game that Oklahoma State does a really good job of getting up for year after year. So this is one where at home I expect Oklahoma State to win it. And even though it is a little bit more than a field goal, I will not be at all surprised this ends up being a two-possession win for the
cool.
Cowboys.
All right, let's jump around to a couple other conferences. I want to talk about this Northwestern team because it ended up being my best bet. I had a buddy who's a pro bettor text me, I think Thursday night, kind of gave me a little heads up to Northwestern. I mean, I was looking at the game, but laying double digits with a team that I faded all last year because of their inept offense seemed a little treacherous. But the more I thought about it with the new quarterback, new OC, new system, it's pretty impressive with them. And now I know Maryland stinks.
Yeah, and that's part of it. That's probably part of what he was thinking too, is that Maryland's right. Awful.
Right. But here they are catching points. And I'm intrigued by Northwestern. This could be a bet on team for a while here because they could be underrated. And I think Iowa's got some dysfunction with all the Kirk Ferentz allegations. So I'm looking at Northwestern to get the win.
Yeah, I don't think it would be surprising at all if Iowa ends up having a bad season. You know, giving everything that they did go through in the offseason, wouldn't surprise me if there's some division in the locker room. I'm not saying that there is, but if we were to find that out after the fact, that it would almost be expected. And so, you know, you see them lose last week at home against a Purdue team that, you know, was without its best player, was without its head coach. And I don't know, what do you make of Iowa coming off of that? And then Northwestern on the other side is a team that I know our metrics really liked coming into the season. It was one that was quite honestly making me a little uneasy as I would look at the preseason ratings. And I'm seeing Northwestern as a top 25 team. Like Northwestern was ranked 25th by FPI coming into the season. And knowing how bad that offense was last year. And like you said, new offensive coordinator, new quarterback transferred in from Indiana. You're expecting them to be better offensively. No way they'd be as bad as they were a year ago. You're also expecting their defense to be pretty good based on, you know, what they had coming back. But they did lose a couple of good players who opted out. And the idea that they could go from what they were last year to a fringe top 25 team just seemed a little bit too much too fast for me. But you know, they looked in week one like they could be that good. I mean, not contending for the conference good, but good enough to be a fringe top 25 type team. And if you do buy into them in that way and you consider, you know, what Iowa might be, that this seems to be value here with Northwestern catching points. You remember recent years before last year, how good they were on the road in the Big Ten. And Pat Fitzgerald just always is getting the most out of his guys. So let's put it this way. If they go out and they look really good again this week, this might be one of the last times this season that you'll be able to catch points with Northwestern. So I'm with you on this. I think Northwestern is still probably better than people are realizing. I think a lot of last week, they're just chalking up to Maryland being that bad. And I think Maryland is that bad. But I think Northwestern is also better than we think. And maybe they'll come out and show it again this week. And then a lot of people will start to swing back over to them being, you know, what they had been before last year.
Gotcha. No, I just felt like I was impressed with how comfortable the offense and how polished it looked in an opener running
Peyton Ramsey's
new style.
A good quarterback.
No, I know that. I know that.
I'm saying that for your audience. Like it's
Indiana, he was good.
You know, FPI, and we talk about FPI and our metrics and all that all the time. Of course, another metric that we look at individually is total QBR. And even though those Indiana teams, you know, showed flashes, but just had difficulty with consistency, Peyton Ramsey was routinely a top 25 quarterback nationally in total QBR. So he does a lot of stuff right, and it will not be surprising at all if he makes a big difference for this Northwestern offense.
Good. Yeah, no, I'm a big fan. I'm a big fan of Tom Allen. I like that they got the win last week, although I questioned the call, the referee's call, that is. One team I've had a trouble figuring out is Virginia Tech.
Yeah.
Because they have sort of like an old school offense because they run the ball so much. They do spread, but it's just so different. In Louisville, I was happy I went with team total. Obviously, they had a beatdown. That was a really like safe play, and I was very confident in it. But it's a game that really intrigues me. I love Satterfield, but I've been disappointed at times, some of his clock management, his defense at times. So I don't know if I trust Louisville to cover, even though I like getting 3.5 at home.
I like there to be a lot of points scored in this game. Louisville's defense is not great. They did okay against Florida State, but I don't think you can make too much out of that. Virginia Tech runs the ball very well, and Louisville's run defense is their biggest weakness. So I think that Virginia Tech will probably go back to scoring a lot of points like they had up until last weekend. I don't know what happened against Wake and why they couldn't score more. But I think that's just a blip on the radar screen. And I think I think they'll kind of assert themselves in the running game against Louisville's defense. But then on the other hand, you saw Louisville's offense really wake up against Florida State and kind of had its way. And Virginia Tech, I remember, you know, telling you on TV last week, I thought that Virginia Tech's defense was going to get better as they, you know, gain more continuity with guys being back from sitting out from COVID and the defensive coordinator being back and all that, but they didn't really show that last week either. So I think both offenses are going to have a field day in this one. I think there are going to be a lot of points scored.
Well, the over-under suggests as much. 67 is your total. Is that still too low in your eyes?
I think so. Yeah. Okay. I see both teams easily being in the 30s and you know, obviously they both get to 35. I'd be a little surprised if at least one of them doesn't get in the 40s.
Okay. What, you know, before I let you go, there's like Heisman predictor, things like that.
Yeah.
The only reason I ask is the betting market went from Justin Fields plus 750 after last week's performance to like less than 2-1 or something like that, even though Trevor Lawrence is still the favorite. Any sort of projections you guys have in FPI on that front? And also, where do you see Ohio State in the FPI predictor?
Yeah. So, Ohio State's the number one team in FPI right now. Number two offense behind Alabama, but number one team overall. And I think their offense is just going to put up such big numbers in conference play that Fields is going to be really easy to latch on to. And I think I had mentioned this to you recently. I can't remember if it was on the air or not, but just the idea that with Heisman voters, let's remember, it's not a committee like the playoff. It's 900 and something different people. Some of them don't follow college football all that closely. And most of them are very heavily biased to get, you know, by what they see most recently. So the recency bias is a huge deal, you know, down the stretch with the Heisman race. And because of that, I was of the attitude that what Trevor Lawrence did in the first month or so of the season really wasn't going to mean a whole lot, because most people are only going to be looking at, you know, one, what he does against Notre Dame in their most watched game of the season, but also what is he doing on Saturdays in response to what Justin Fields is doing at Ohio State, and maybe even to a lesser degree, Mac Jones or Najee Harris at Alabama, and whoever else you want to throw into that race. But it was kind of like the Heisman race wasn't really going to start until Justin Fields started playing. And so now it's like, okay, what does Trevor Lawrence do on those Saturdays? And that's what's going to carry the most weight. And, you know, it wasn't great last week. I don't think it's that's a huge deal. I think the Notre Dame game and beyond is going to be ultimately what tells his story from a Heisman perspective. But I don't think that Justin Fields, you know, has a ton of ground to make up because he hadn't been playing all this time. I think this is really when a lot of the Heisman voters start paying attention and pretty much always have in the past. Now, I mean, if you were awful for the first six games, then, you know, you have no shot at this point. But if you don't really have any knocks against you, I think just the fact that you have more quality performances isn't going to mean a whole lot to most Heisman voters. So I would say Justin Fields' chance of winning the Heisman is every bit as good as Trevor Lawrence's right now.
Yeah, I would agree. I did something last week. If you're going to bet it now at 750. I mean, it's only going to get lower. And sure enough, it jumped a lot. So, all right, my man. Well, good stuff. It was fun to talk some football and also a little Dodgers talk, and always good picking your brain.
This is going to be weird. I mean, now that baseball is over, which, of course, it always is this time of year, but we're used to NBA and NHL having started this month of November, except for the Masters being there out of nowhere. I mean, it's all football. I mean, this is fun. I mean, this is, if you love college football in the NFL, there's nothing going against you for the next month, actually month and a half, really, right? So it is football time in America, and it's going to be awesome.
Nice. All right, man. Be well, and we'll get you back on here soon.
Sounds good.
Sounds to me like you guys a couple of bookies.
All right, time now to welcome in our MMA handicappers, Matthew and Lou. Fellas, well done. Well done last week. We nailed the over-under in the main event, and the co-main we lost, but basically I think we swept the board on everything else. So Lou, congratulations. Matthew, congratulations. Very pleased with that. I know a lot of our loyal listeners are. As we turn the page, not as big of a card or hyped main event like Nurmagomedov, but we are back in stateside, the UFC Apex in Las Vegas. So that means smaller octagon. And we have Anderson Silva, one of the legends in the sport, in the main event against Uriah Hall. And Matthew, you're involved in this main event here.
Yeah, I like the over 4.5 rounds here. First of all, main event overs have been a killer. You know, we actually hit the under last week, bucking that over trend. It certainly got home. That one was never going to be in doubt as Justin Gaethje seemed gassed in round one, and the moment got the best of him. But in this fight, I think we have an interesting scenario here where this is Anderson Silva's last fight in the UFC. And at 45 years old, there's a lot of question marks if it probably should be his last fight ever. But yet he's still a pretty durable guy. This is a guy who lately, well into his 40s, has been in there with the likes of Israel Adesanya, Jared Cannonier, Daniel Cormier. And three of his last four losses are by decision. His durability has certainly held up. And in here, we have a scenario where the UFC intentionally, for Anderson Silva's last fight, gave him a stand-up striker, and not just a stand-up striker, but a stylistic stand-up striker in Uriah Hall. I think these guys are both going to try a few things. You're going to see a few Uriah Hall spin kicks. I mean, Anderson Silva was his idol. The whole reason Uriah Hall got into MMA was because of Anderson Silva. Sometimes it's hard to go out there and try to hurt your idol. And in this case, Anderson Silva's a tough guy to hurt anyway. I mean, if you're able to go the distance with Adesanya and Daniel Cormier, you could probably go the distance with Uriah Hall, who's also 36 years old. This one just has slow-paced, fun, jump off the fence, spin kicks that don't land, kickboxing match written all over it. I think it's certainly going to the judges' scorecard. Don't be surprised if there's not a lot of damage inflicted by either guy here. Great big hug at the end. Nice send off for Anderson Silva, win or lose, and call it a career for the future Hall of Famer. But this one's going to the judges' scorecards.
Lou, do you have an opinion on the side or total there?
Yeah, you know, history's riddled with fighters that don't know when to stop. Anderson Silva's name right now and photo is in the dictionary next to that. The only stat that I would warn people about here regarding Silva is that only as Silva has absorbed more significant strikes than he has landed in his career, only nine times in 24 bouts. That tells you the fluidity and defensive prowess of the guy. However, of the nine times he's absorbed more significant strikes than he's landed, those have been, seven of those have come in his last nine fights. So, excuse me, in his last eight fights. So, Silva's, everything about Silva has waned. The smaller cage doesn't help him. I hope you guys are right on that over, Matthew. I think that you're looking at a 45-year-old guy that's been gifted an opponent, and it may not go as well as he seems. The one other thing that I will say that contributed to me staying off of this fight is that Silva has, in his recent history, been popped for PEDs. And this, his last fight, what would prevent him from trying to bend the rules a little bit? So with the amount of unknowns in this fight, I can't touch it.
You know, it's a great point, Matthew, with, in terms of got fighters who are stay around too long. Silva obviously is a legend in this sport, but I know I see the logic with like the not much action back and forth, but isn't there a chance Silva's just washed up?
He is washed up. I think he's like washed up.
To the point where he can't go five rounds.
But he's proven that he can, and he's proven that he can recently against killers. Israel Adesanya is a killer. And, you know, he was able to hang in there. And again, if you watch the Israel Adesanya fight, and Israel Adesanya is a much more creative, devastating, faster striker than a 36-year-old Uriah Hall. I thought that Anderson did a good job, again, of avoiding damage. And I just think in this fight, they're both going to try some fun stuff. Anderson's reflexes aren't what they used to be. His last few wins are by decision. This is a guy that doesn't win by KO the way he used to anymore. This is a guy that tends to win by decision now. In fact, his last two wins, and there haven't been many for Silva lately, Derek Brunson and Nick Diaz, were both by decision. This is a guy who in later in his age tends to win decisions or lose decisions. And I just feel like, is Uriah Hall really going to go in there and just mop the floor and knock out a guy that Israel Adesanya, Daniel Cormier, and these guys didn't? I think it's unlikely. I mean, it's certainly possible at 45. And I agree that he should stop fighting. He's only fighting to fulfill his contract. In his mind, he's one of these guys that says, I signed a contract. I have to fulfill it. This is it. This is the last fight on his contract. He makes no bones about this is his last fight. I don't think anyone anticipates him fighting again, at least not in the UFC. I have heard some rumblings of some kind of legend matches that they put on over in Bellator, whether it be with Vitor Belfort or another one with Chael, you know, but at least in the UFC, this is his last time fighting against elite guys. And I think this fight makes sense for him. Uriah Hall is one of those guys, I think, if you allow him to get into a standing karate match, then he's going to be happy to do it. Throw some spin kicks, show off the athletic ability he has. You might even see some cool kicks be thrown in this fight. I just don't know if any of them are going to finish the fight. And I think at the end of the day, this one goes to the scorecards. And I think when we start tracking the amount of strikes that actually land in this fight, people are going to be surprised how low it is.
Okay, awesome. All right, so let's turn the page to the second fight on the card, Andre Feely against Bryce Mitchell. Feely is a dog here, plus 130. Lou, you're on the dog.
Yeah, you know, this in a card where I know there's going to be some dogs, I'm just having a hard time at this juncture really uncovering them. The one that I think makes a lot of sense to me is Mitchell against Feely. And the reason I like Feely is pretty simple. He has a deeper set of experience. He's faced a much better opponent. And though he's 30 years old to Mitchell's 36, physically they're almost the same as far as height, although Feely will have a 4-inch reach advantage. 28 pro fights for Feely, 13 pro fights for Mitchell, and that experience and who Feely's been in with, coupled with the well-rounded nature of his game, tells me that I think his experience and his well-rounded ability give him advantage over a guy in Mitchell that absolutely has to, he's a BJJ practitioner, he has to clasp and then drag the fight to the floor. I've often said on the podcast that, you know, kryptonite to BJJ is really good wrestling, and Feely's out of the alpha male camp in Northern Cal, and that's all they are, is a bunch of wrestlers. Feely will have advantage on the feet, and is provided he keeps it there, I think he schools Mitchell. If he decides to fight this fight on the floor with Mitchell, I think he's choosing to fight Mitchell at his advantage, and I think he's too smart for that. And for that reason, I like Feely as a modest underdog, anywhere from plus 125 to plus 135, depending where you're shopping.
I completely agree with Lou here. I really like Andre Touchy Feely. First of all, best nickname in all of combat sports, no Touchy Feely. But second of all, I mean, you can only go so far in UFC, and we've seen it time and time again, that guys that only have one, that specialize in one area, they tend to hit a ceiling. And Bryce Mitchell, at just 26 years old, certainly has plenty of time to develop his all-around game. But what's interesting to me is, for a guy who's such a submission specialist, that in his four fights in the UFC, which he's 4-0, he only has one submission in the UFC. And look at the level of competition. It's as low as it gets in the UFC. Tyler Diamond, Bobby Moffitt, Matt Sales. I mean, Charles Rosa is the only guy that anyone's even heard of in the UFC that he fought. That really is like the lowest level of competition. Great for Bryce Mitchell that, you know, he's had some amazing looking submissions outside the UFC, had a really good submission in the UFC against Sales. But for the most part, he's just dragging these overwhelmed guys to the ground, attempting submissions, not getting them, and winning by decision. Andre Feely's losses in his career come against Max Holloway, Yair Rodriguez, Calvin Kattar, Michael Johnson. This is a guy who's been in with the best of the best at 135 and 145 pounds. And he has some big wins. Miles Jury, Dennis Bermudez, Shaman Moraes, Charles Jourdain. Charles Jourdain was a huge favorite in his last fight. Touchy Feely was able to get it done pretty easy there. And this is a tough guy to submit in Andre Feely. His last three losses all come by decision. He hasn't been submitted since 2015. And this is a guy who fights two or three times a year, a really active fighter in Andre Feely. So look, I think he's definitely going to win the stand-up exchanges. I think his wrestling to lose point, maybe the kryptonite, at least defensively, to keep this one standing. Just all around, too much experience, too much well-rounded advantages for Andre Feely, not to take him at the plus price.
All right. I love it when you guys are on the same fighter, and it's always encouraging, so to speak. As we've discussed, we're going to hop around to just the fights that we have plays on. So let's jump all the way down to the prelims. And Matthew, you're on Alex Hernandez as a big favorite, and obviously at minus 350, 370. Just, you know, how would you approach this if somebody's not, doesn't have quite the stomach to lay that kind of wood?
Sure. And look, so since we started being back on the podcast, since I started being back on it in May, basically when the UFC re-kicked off during COVID, we've only played two of these big favorites, but we're 2-0. And we played one last week with Ankil Levy. He easily got the KO win in the first round. Sometimes there are mismatches in MMA, and because it's so infrequent in the UFC, value's value, and you have to take advantage of it. So at the end of the day, if we're laying more than minus 300, we have to win four for every one we lose. Now we've hit two in a row. I think this is the third here. Alex Hernandez has had five fights in the UFC. He came into the UFC undefeated with a ton of hype. And look at the five guys he's fought in the UFC. Cowboy Cerrone, Drew Dober, Olivier Aubin-Mercier, Beneil Dariush, Francisco Trinaldo. Five fights, all against ranked opponents, and he's 3-2 in those fights. I mean, the win against Beneil Dariush couldn't have aged any better, as he's on fire. Trinaldo at the time was on an amazing run. this is a guy who's really well-rounded, super athletic, ran into a buzzsaw on Drew Dober in his last fight. And that Elevation Fight team, we know how well they've been doing lately. I think that Hernandez is primed for a big win. This is literally the easiest opponent and the biggest step down in class that Hernandez has had in the last 5 years. And for Grootzemacher on the other side, he hasn't fought since April 2018, over 2.5 years since this guy has gotten a fight. And now he gets thrown into the wolves against the super aggressive, hard-hitting Alexander Hernandez here. And look at the losses. Grootzemacher's 1-2 in his last three in the UFC. The only win over a really deteriorated and old Joe Lozon. But the losses, Devi Ramos, Chaz Skelly, those are guys that are already well below the level of Alexander Hernandez. So this guy he's going to have height disadvantages, Grootzemacher. He's going to have reach disadvantages. He's going to have rust for not fighting in 2.5 years. Even when he was actively fighting, he was losing to guys lesser than Hernandez. Unless he's made some dramatic improvements outside the cage, this feels like a mismatch, and I'd go ahead and use Alexander Hernandez here.
Lou, do you have an opinion?
All I can add is that I've watched Groots train. He used to train here in Phoenix at the MMA lab. And without getting too involved in it, he's had a hard time staying at camps. He's not well-liked. That's all I'll say.
Okay. All right. Sounds good. I just love bouncing around. Now, Lou, you wanted to talk about this one fight that you thought was too uneven in terms of the money line and all that. Which one was? Oh, that was the last fight. I skipped it. So the Bobby Green fight. I mean, he's minus 300.
And you lead me, that's perfect, because you lead me right into it, because I really want to take exactly what Matthew just said and transport it to this fight. I mean, he's exactly correct. Sometimes if the number says 345, but the guy should be 700, then there should be no hesitation to lay in the wood. And that Matthew has conviction on Hernandez. And I understand that. But when I look at Bobby Green and Thiago Moises, and I see a number like 290 or 300 next to Bobby Green, that's when I start to feel completely opposite. I don't think that's warranted. He's got a wealth of experience over, he's 34 and has a wealth of experience over the 25-year-old Moises, who's completely one-dimensional and must get a sub. Bobby Green has enough wrestling chops to be able to utilize strong takedown defense, and he's a boxer. He's won his last three. And quite honestly, there's a lot of momentum, and this is when Bobby Green is most dangerous to bettors who like him, because he lets them down. He's filled with uneven performances. The guy is very hard to trust, and he's in there with a kid that is, if he gets a hold of his leg or his arm, I think he can take Bobby out. Bobby's got to keep this on the feet, and I think that laying that kind of a price, most fights start on the feet, but they will hit the floor. I like what Moises did to Michael Johnson after totally getting painted on the feet for one round. He went out and tackled the kid, got a hold of his leg, and heel hooked him. I think he's going to be able to get a clasp on Bobby Green. I could see Bobby Green being a minus 180 here, maybe a minus 195, but into the 300s, that's an obtuse number, and I'm going to be forced to begin to try and handicap and look seriously at Moises.
Okay, and so it has your attention. Go ahead, Matthew.
I tend to agree. I was looking for a reason to take Thiago Moises here, and it very well may end up on my card too, and for a lot of the similar reasons that Lou just said. And, you know, while Bobby Green is on a three-fight winning streak, those wins are against Clay Guida, Lando Venata, Alan Patrick. I mean, Guida's probably washed up, and all of his wins come by decision. This is a guy in Bobby Green who just doesn't have any finishing power at this point, and that's not going to bode well. He is really athletic. He's tough to finish himself, But Moises is a guy that if he gets you on the ground, he is so strong. They talk about how strong this guy is. And we saw it in the Michael Johnson fight that Lou alluded to. He was getting chopped up by Michael Johnson for one round and literally just dove in and grabbed his ankle and pulled him down and heel hooked him. Once he got to the ground, you knew it was over. It's an interesting spot. At least if nothing else, we always talk to path to victory for an underdog. And you certainly know what the path to victory here is for Thiago Moises. If you decide to make a play on the underdog, that if he gets Bobby Green down, Bobby's going to have a heck of a time trying to get Thiago Moises off him and avoid a submission.
All right. I like it. Everyone likes big dogs to cash. So, can't go wrong with that. Now you guys, I believe are both on the with Williams fight. Lou, why don't you start us off there?
Yeah, this is an undercard fight, and it takes a little bit of digging, and it's basically a fade of one fighter as much as it is backing the other. Witt against Williams, both round one losers in their last out, but a closer look to Witt shows that his loss to Sato in the first round, he took the fight on like a two-day notice. He was having a hard time getting sanctioned, and he was getting stomped and tested and plugged and all kinds of reviewed, and he had hardly any time to prepare for that fight. Meanwhile, Cole Williams, a kid out of Iowa fighting, 36 years old, really kind of a jobber and a gatekeeper, and I question whether he should even be here. Claudio Silva submitted him in the first round in his last out. I think the UFC's putting these two guys together, and they know that Williams doesn't belong and Witt does. This fight opened Williams minus 120 to Witt plus 105, and now it's switched. And while I usually am skeptical of that kind of a move, in this case, I totally agree with it. And Witt minus 140, I think, is a very, very worthy consideration.
And one of the things we always talk about is level of competition on the regional scene. And both of these guys are 0-1, losing their UFC debuts. But what does that mean? Who have they fought on the regional scene? Jason Witt's been in there with a lot of UFC and Bellator guys, Isaac Valley Flag, Mark Leminger, who's one of the better guys in Bellator with an 11-2 career record. Witt beat Leminger, Dakota Cochran. So Witt's been in there with a lot of guys, at least that we would consider UFC/Bellator caliber, where Williams hasn't been in there with anybody, and he looked completely overmatched in his UFC debut. Couldn't agree with Lou Moore. Even though there's been a dramatic price change, I still think at minus 140, the value's on Witt.
Okay, good. I think people are gaming to lay 140. That's not too bad. But in the one fight before that on the card, Ledet and Jacoby. Jacoby is minus 320, and I believe, Matthew, you're on this fight.
Yeah, I took Justin Ledé here, plus 260 against Dustin Jacoby, and this was more of a fade of Jacoby, as well as the fact that Ledé is going to be the bigger guy. So Ledé's last three losses are Alexander Rajcik, Aleska Kamer, and Johnny Walker, all at light heavyweight. So this is a guy who's used to fighting at light heavyweight against some of the best guys in the UFC, including Johnny Walker, who's a top five ranked contender now at light heavyweight. 6'4". I mean, a big guy that looks like he should legitimately be fighting at 205 pounds. This is Dustin Jacoby's second stint in the UFC. And while he's done well on the regional scene, Dustin Jacoby is 0-5 in his last fights that are fought in either UFC, Bellator, or World Series of Fighting. So every time Dustin Jacoby has stepped back into a major organization, he has lost and failed. 0-5 in those last five fights in any of those three major organizations. This is a guy that, look, padded his record on the regional scene. Dana White always liked him, gave him another shot on Dana White Contender Series, where Dustin Jacoby was able to get a decision win, and now he finds himself back in the UFC for the second time, fighting a bigger, stronger, younger guy who's been in there with some big-time talent at 205. I think plus 260 on Justin Ledé may be the bargain of the card.
Interesting. Lou, do you have anything on there?
No, but I like where Matthew's going with it. I tend to see a guy that goes 0-2 and comes back to the UFC once he's kicked out as having desperation. And at 0-5, Jacoby's going to have desperation. But I would never, the reason I glazed over that fight is because I would never consider laying 310. But after Matthew's breakdown, I sure would consider taking the plus 260.
Yeah, no, I liked the breakdown, potential value on the card. So I like that.
Doubt.
That's all I got, fellas. Good, short, quick, and easy for us. Anything to add that I may have missed?
I wouldn't mind mentioning just one future fight upcoming for the listeners, if I may. And we can break this down when the time comes. This is a fight that's coming up in December. It'll be the championship bout for the bantamweight title between champion Petr Yan and Aljamain Sterling. This fight opened Yan a pretty serious favorite, and there's been some money come in on Sterling, thus to the point now that Aljo is plus 115 or plus 120 where you shop. And the reason I want to bring this up now is because I believe by the time this fight goes off, it's going to be much closer to a pick'em. And Aljamain Stewart, for numerous reasons that I will point out at the time, I think is in a really desirable position here. And I think we should get him now while he's plus money before it gets before the last 20 cents gets sucked out and it gets closer to a pick.
I don't have any problem with stuff like that. I think anytime that somebody has a really good inclination that the odds are going to dramatically move, then it's good to tell people ahead of time, hey, if you have interest in this, or you think you're going to have interest in this fight, now's the time to go ahead and get your wagers down. It's no different than when's the right time to sell your house, when's the right time to invest in stock, when's the right time to place a wager. Couldn't agree with Lou anymore. Hey, if this line's going to move dramatically, take advantage of the inefficient market now.
Yeah, I'm all for that. All right, fellas, great stuff as always. Really appreciate your time. I know our listeners do too. And let's just keep it rolling here in the UFC.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks, Lou. Best of luck this weekend, everybody.
You bet. Thanks, everyone, and good luck.
All right, that's going to do it for this pod. Thanks to Matthew and Lou, and thanks to Brad Edwards, of course, and thank you to the Dodgers for finally ending that 32-year drought. So thanks to everyone for downloading, rating, reviewing, subscribing, all that good stuff, and I will catch you back here Thursday with John Murray as we try to stay hot and baby bankroll bonanza.